move to the third case of the morning, Doris Anichin versus Meritech. Mr. Fugger.
May it please the court, Mr. Anderson. I'm Steve Fiewiger, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff in this case, Doris Merline Anichin. I will refer to her throughout my argument as Merline because that is the name that she commonly goes by. We are here on the appeal of the court's order of July 30, 2004, granting summary judgment on Ms. Anichin's claim of race discrimination and on her claim of sex discrimination in employment relating to her termination from Meritech as a manager back on September 6, 2004. In this case, we believe that we've raised evidence of direct evidence of racially motivated activity by one of the decision makers in this case, Scott Shaw. Ms. Anichin was, in this case, a middle manager who was supervised by Mr. Shaw and the general manager in this Rock Island office, call center office, Mary Ellen Williams. It is undisputed that Ms. Anichin, or Merline, had no formal discipline in the 8 years that she worked for Meritech, and that she was meeting the employer's legitimate business expectations in the performance of her T10 manager's position as she was working during the summer of 2001. What changed, and what I think Judge Mim ignored in his ruling on summary judgment, was that my client became involved with the relationship with a subordinate, Ray Jones, an African-American call center representative, which, according to the testimony, was disapproved of by the managers. Namely, Mr. Shaw and Ms. Williams both admitted in deposition testimony that they talked to both of them about the fact that they had this relationship going on.
Is there any evidence that it was disapproved of on racial grounds or disapproved of simply because it was an interoffice relationship?
There is evidence that can be weighed in this case in the light most favorable to the plaintiff that it was. Ms. Anichin specifically said in her testimony that when Ms. Williams was talking to her about this relationship, that she acknowledged, Ms. Williams did, that while inter-office relationships occur, we have cultural differences here compared, you know, if this happened in Chicago, this may not be a big deal. But in this case, she mentioned the fact that we're here in Rock Island and we may have cultural differences in how people perceive this relationship going on. And therefore,
we're in that office.
What's that?
I've relative size. Obviously, Chicago is a big place. I wondered if the size of the office and the proximity of working and the frequency of encounter was a problem.
This is a large call center. It's more than 300 employees, I believe. But the levels that they're at are about third level down from the general manager here.
You have
the He is below her. Mr. Jones is. She's supervising him at this time.
She's supervising him.
Correct.
And dating him.
Right.
That's not a problem, huh?
Well, it wasn't a problem when Ms. Williams was dating her subordinate in the same office, and it wasn't a problem when Mr. Shaw was dating a subordinate in his office also.
So those are the similarly situated people you're saying that were treated differently.
Well, I think they are. I think that's one argument in this case. But I think we also have the direct evidence issue here that the court seemed to weigh in a light most favorable to Meritech rather than giving the benefit of the doubt of the statement to Ms. Enikin on summary judgment. In this case, my client had a what you would call a buddy coach, or somebody. She had just been moved up to this managerial position, and so therefore, as the training period was going on, she had a lady by the name of Pam Moulton, who was already a manager in her level, monitoring her pursuant to instructions of Mr. Shaw and pursuant to typical Meritech policy to see how the managers are doing here as they get acclimated to their position. Both Mr. Shaw and Ms. Williams, according to Ms. Moulton, in the month of August 2001, called her aside repeatedly and asked how my client was doing and asked her specific questions about the relationship between Ms. Enikin and Mr. Jones and how did she feel that was affecting them and so forth. But the more telling thing that happened was that sometime at the same time in which the issue raising for discipline in this case occurred was that Mr. Shaw had a conversation with Ms. Moulton which stated that they don't like it and that we had to get rid of her, meaning Ms. Enikin. And Ms. Moulton interpreted that and said forth in her affidavit in resistance to the summary judgment that at that point she was clear that he was referring to the interracial relationship aspect of their situation there. And then that statement, according to the record, was made sometime between August 2nd and August 21st, 2004. At the same time, then, this CAS application arises, which says, you improperly access this record, Ms. Enikin. That's a violation of our code of conduct, and therefore you're going to be terminated for that. Well, we believe that this court erred in finding that Ms. Moulton's testimony suggests nothing about the discrimination based on the interracial character of the relationship. It ignores her affidavit and construes that testimony favorable to Ameritech. In the Shager versus Upjohn case, this court held that the test or the task of disambiguity ambiguous utterances is for a trial and not for summary judgment. On a motion for summary judgment, the ambiguities in a witness's testimony must be resolved in favor of the non-moving party. In that case, you know, here we have a statement being made by a decision maker saying, we don't like this. And Ms. Moulton saying, I believe that was relating to the interracial nature of this relationship. And that, therefore, we believe that the court erred in not finding that there's a question of fact as to whether or not that constitutes direct evidence of discrimination in this situation.
What's your theory on that gender discrimination claim?
That she's been treated more harshly than similarly situated males in this situation. The court found that we made our prima facie case. The court then found that the legitimate non-discriminatory reason given was that she engaged in the code of conduct violation and therefore was terminated. We believe that we have sufficient evidence to establish pretext in this case based on the fact that other similarly situated males who have engaged in much worse conduct, namely stealing from customers by cramming their accounts, were let off the hook by Mr. Shaw and Ms. Williams. And in fact, Ms. Williams was pointed out by another call center employee from another location that another gentleman by the name of John Tucker had been slamming this call center woman's account when she was trying to set up service, and that no discipline was imposed on this gentleman at all. We also think that with respect to pretext, the court ignores the get rid of her statement in analyzing the case. It simply says, okay, we're going to go through McDonnell Douglas and find that you've made the prima facie case. I'm going to accept the the production of the legitimate business reason, but then drops all of this, what's happened, out of the analysis here. And we believe that with Mr. Shaw making that statement that we have to get rid of her, that brings into question the legitimacy of their reason. In this situation, we had another manager testify, Ms. Hoffman, that, and Ms. Moulton did this also, that when it came time to investigate, there really wasn't an investigation done. That they just, because the screenshot came up saying that Ms. Inikin did it, because it was under her ID, that was all they did. Ms. Moulton and Ms. Hoffman testified that there's a simple procedure computerly to use here, namely do a cradle-to-grave search, which could enable the managers to find out where that was accessed from and in aid the investigation in determining whether or not here we are, you know, are we accusing the right person in this situation.
Before you sit down, I'd like to ask you about something that was a little troubling to me to read, that you close your brief speaking of Judge Mim by saying, quote, the district court twisted all the facts it could to ensure it would not have to go through the work of a trial. I found that to be a pretty surprising statement to make.
Well, I think
a little over the top. Personally, I think writing a 31-page opinion on a summary judgment motion is probably as much work as actually trying this case. Any comment about that?
Well,
reflection, whether that
maybe
appropriate statement.
Maybe that was just in the heat of the moment, Your Honor. I mean,
the heat of the moment usually comes in a courtroom when you're saying something that you wish you hadn't said, not when you're reflectively writing a brief to persuade a court. Here, I think it's accusing Judge Mim of being unethical by twisting the facts.
I was not trying to be adverse
to working hard, being lazy or something, and not wanting to avoid a trial.
I apologize if the court believes that's the intent of my statement.
Is that what I believe? What do you think?
What do I think? I think that
about that statement.
I think that in this situation we had a lot of facts available to us to say that the common sense showed that my client was not responsible for this.
And sure, the judge could have been wrong in misinterpreting material facts that were in dispute, but that he did this, twisted it, and he did it so he would avoid the work of a trial? And that's what you wrote.
I understand, and if the court takes offense to that, I apologize for that statement, and I will issue an apology to Judge Mim then, too.
I don't know if Judge Mim will ever read this. Maybe you better not apologize if you have to practice in Peoria. But I know when I was a trial judge, I never read the briefs that went up in cases I handled. But anyway, I just thought it was a kind of an over-the-top statement, and I was surprised to see it.
Okay. And is my time up, except for rebuttal at this point? I'm sorry.
Mr. Anderson?
Good morning. May it please the court. To start off with, it's important to make sure we have firmly in mind exactly what the claims are and what plaintiff has already conceded as to certain of the claims. Counsel talked about two claims, a race discrimination claim, and a sex discrimination claim. There are really three claims on this appeal. There's a claim that Ameritech fired Ms. Inikin because she was involved in this interracial relationship. There's a claim that they fired her because of reverse discrimination, what plaintiff perhaps unfortunately terms his pure race claim, which would be a reverse discrimination claim because Ms. Inikin was white. And then there's a sex discrimination claim that she was fired because she was a woman. Now, as to the second two of those, the reverse discrimination claim and the sex discrimination claim, Ms. Eniken does not attempt to proceed under what the case is referred to as the direct method. She relies only on the McDonnell-Douglas analysis for those claims. Now, as to the other claim, that she was fired because she was involved in this relationship with an African-American coworker, she proceeds only under the direct method. She concedes that as to that claim, she did not present evidence of any similarly situated employees who were not involved in interracial relationships who were treated more favorably.
This circuit apparently hasn't decided whether an interracial relationship is grounds for a Title VII case, but I don't see that you've challenged that at all.
We have not, Your Honor. So we have conceded for purposes of this appeal that that's a viable...
Accept that that's a viable theory.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And again, on that claim, there really is no McDonnell-Douglas analysis in this case because plaintiffs conceded she can't make out a prima facie case because she hasn't pointed to any similarly situated person who was not in what would be the protected group under that kind of a claim, who was not involved in an interracial relationship. She does try to proceed on that interracial relationship claim under what's referred to as the direct method. And the primary piece of evidence that she relies on in doing that is this testimony from another manager named Pam Moulton. And Ms. Moulton is the one who testifies that she had a conversation with one of the two decision makers, Scott Shaw, and that in that conversation, Scott Shaw said, people don't like the relationship between plaintiff and Mr. Jones, and I, Mr. Shaw, have to do something about that, which Ms. Moulton interpreted to mean get rid of plaintiff. Now, of course, that's all disputed, but on summary judgment, the evidence is what the evidence is. Now, plaintiff repeats over and over in her briefs and here today that Ms. Moulton's testimony means that Mr. Shaw said, I'm going to get rid of her because she's in a relationship with an African-American man, because she's in a relationship and because that's interracial. Now, not only does Ms. Moulton's testimony not say that, her testimony flatly contradicts that notion. There's nothing ambiguous about it. We're not asking this court to decide what ambiguous testimony means. Ms. Moulton testified that she never heard Mr. Shaw, Ms. Williams, or anybody else in the Rock Island call center say a single word about the difference in race between plaintiff and Mr. Jones. Nobody. So when she says that Mr. Shaw said people had a problem with the relationship or didn't like it, elsewhere in her testimony, which is reproduced in the briefs, she said the reason for that was Mr. Shaw's perception that the relationship was interfering with plaintiffs getting her job done, that it was causing a problem in the workplace because she wasn't doing her job, not because she was white and he was black. Ms. Moulton flatly contradicts that.
Now, this is because of the contact during work hours and whatever, visiting?
I'm not sure whether, I'm a little hesitant because I'm not sure what's in the appeal record and what's not, but there was testimony that that was the problem. They were spending too much time chatting at work and not getting their work done.
Was there any discipline on Jones for anything?
Yes. He was, in the course of the investigation, when the managers and corporate security started interviewing people about this improper CAS application, Mr. Jones was asked whether he was living with plaintiff, and he gave false information. He said, no, I'm living with another male coworker right now. And that wasn't true. They were both, at that moment at least, living at the same apartment. So he was removed. He was actually demoted. He had been in the same kind of a temporary management position that plaintiff was in at the time, which was called a T10 position. And he was demoted from that position and moved back to being just a customer service representative. And then subsequently, I don't know, a couple, 3 months later, he was moved back into the temporary management role. So he had a temporary demotion for essentially for lying during the investigation.
Well, he I guess, said he did not give anyone permission to I guess, search whatever they do to get the...
That's exactly right.
What do you call it?
It's a CAS application, which is essentially a credit application system, and it searches for past bills with the company or other problems with the person's credit record. And that's undisputed that he did not give anybody, including plaintiff, permission to run that CAS application on him in August. Apparently, months earlier in February, when he was in training, as a training demonstration, plaintiff had run a CAS application on Mr. Jones, and he was there, so he had at least tacitly agreed that that was okay at that time. But certainly not in August, and certainly there's no reason to assume that having had permission to do so in February gave her permission to run a CAS application on him any old time she wanted to. That certainly, there's nothing in the record to support that notion.
No, there was someone else that ran a similar test, unauthorized, and was also terminated.
That's right. There was an employee named Dean Lowry who, he didn't run a CAS application, but he searched through a co-employee who he had been dating. He searched through her actual call records to see who she had been calling on the phone. So it's a very similar violation, searching confidential customer records of a co-employee. And he was fired for that, and that was within a month or two after plaintiff was fired, and by the same two decision makers. And that's the only other incident in the record where anybody else at this Rock Island facility was accused of improperly accessing this kind of a record. Again, I maybe I'm overdoing this, but the Moulton testimony, because it really is such a centerpiece of plaintiff's case, plaintiff says over and over that Shaw was going to get rid of her because of her interracial relationship. Well, in a way, that's sort of a species of sophistry because, yes, the relationship was interracial, and if Moulton's testimony is true, Shaw said, well, the relationship's causing problems, so I have to do something about it, meaning, in Moulton's view, get rid of her. So it may be on some literal level true to say I'm getting rid of her because of the interracial relationship, but that's like saying that at the risk of being folksy, if I take my dog to the park and my dog is a yellow Labrador and I get a ticket because my dog's off the leash, that I got a ticket because of my yellow dog. Well, yeah, I did, but it doesn't have anything to do with the dog being yellow. Well, that's the same thing with Moulton's testimony here.
What about that other comment about cultural differences, and the plaintiff contends that's code for race?
Well, in the first place, that was Ms. Williams. That had nothing to do with Mr. Shaw, and there was no testimony that one knew about the other one, that Williams knew about Shaw's alleged comment to Moulton, or that Shaw knew about Williams' alleged comment about culture. So there's really nothing to link the supposed comment about getting rid of her to this supposed comment about culture. So I'm not sure where that gets plaintiff. The other thing to point out about that is that plaintiff's own testimony was that she read what Ms. Williams was saying about culture to be referring at least as much to the difference in age between herself and Mr. Jones as it was about race. So, I mean, that might be a question, you know, that would need to be disambiguated if...
What's the age difference?
I don't know the answer to that. I know Mr. Jones is significantly younger than plaintiff, but I don't know the number of years, Your Honor. There was no age claim in the case, so we didn't really look into that closely.
Is there any kind of an office rule or something about interoffice dating?
There was not at the time, Your Honor. I understand that there may be now, but there was not at the time.
Would you address the gender discrimination claim?
Certainly, Your Honor. The gender discrimination claim, as an initial matter, we do take issue with Judge Mims' finding that as to the similarly situated employees, plaintiff had presented, I think, maybe 8 proposed comparables, and Judge Mims found that 2 of them, Mr. Millbrook and Mr. Dussault, were sufficiently similarly situated to count and to make out her prima facie case.
And these were employees who were doing the slamming, is that right?
Technically it's cramming, Your Honor,
cramming?
which is adding services. They were accused, at least, of adding services to a customer's account that the customer had not ordered.
Okay.
And one of them, at least, was placed on a final warning and suspended pending termination. So he was, in fact, disciplined but not terminated. The other one, at least as far as the record reveals, was not disciplined at all.
Because he sold a lot.
That was Mr. Millbrook, who, that was what the evidence showed Ms. Williams had said, was that she didn't think he'd do it, and besides, he's really good at his job.
Good grammar.
Which may not be right. Which may not be the most admirable motive, but it's certainly not discrimination of any illegal kind under Title VII. Without dwelling on, I think I'll stand on the briefs unless there are questions as to our arguments as to why those two shouldn't have been found to be comparable. Because the far more important point on the gender discrimination claim is Ameritech had a consistently stated, non-discriminatory, straightforward reason for firing Ms. Eniken, which was that she violated the code of conduct by processing this CAS application without either Mr. Jones's permission or the authorization of a supervisor, both of which were required in order to make it okay for her to do that. And for evidence of pretext, there just really isn't any evidence to show either that this wasn't, quote-unquote, the real reason she was fired or that it wasn't a sufficient reason to fire her. Again, the only other person shown by the record to have done a similar violation, Mr. Lowry, was also fired for the same offense. And this cradle-to-grave report issue that Ameritech possibly could have done more to investigate. Well, first of all, Ameritech interviewed other employees, had their corporate security folks come down from suburban Chicago to the Rock Island facility to conduct an investigation and interviews, and they looked into it. And in addition, they had these computer screenshots that say, CAS application on Ray Jones, run by Dolores Merlene and Eiken with her identification number. So certainly there was an investigation here. Second of all, cases including the Little case and the Karyotis case from this court, both of which are in our brief, say that a plaintiff cannot show pretext even if she establishes that the employer engaged in an impulsive and shoddy investigation. Now, that's not what happened here, but even if the lack of this so-called cradle-to-grave report were evidence of a less-than-stellar investigation, that's not enough to show pretext. Now, the additional issue is that nobody testified that at the time that this happened, these cradle-to-grave reports were being used at Ameritech to investigate improper CAS applications or improper accesses of records like this. I think the testimony was it was just something that was relatively new at the time. And then the last thing, or the last important thing, that plaintiff talks about in the pretext context is that the court should look back at Shaw's alleged statement about doing something about the interracial relationship as evidence that the non-discriminatory explanation is somehow pretext with respect to the sex discrimination claim. Now, I've tried very hard, and I really don't understand how that makes sense to say that because he allegedly said there's a problem with this relationship in the workplace, and therefore we have to do something about that, that can be used to show pretext when you're talking about whether or not she was discriminated against because she was a woman. That just seems flatly illogical to me. I see, unless there are further questions, I think I'll wrap it up.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Wigger? You got 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. With respect to the argument that the shoddy investigation versus the issue of pretext in this case, we'd cite the court back to the Peters versus Renaissance Hotel decision, where the court may look behind an employer's performance or an employee's performance or disciplinary record to determine if they represent an employer's honest assessment of the employee's conduct. The court does not have to take the employer at its word if good reason and common sense belie the employer's assessment. Then pretext may have been shown. Well, we pointed out in our argument here numerous issues on the common sense argument here. Ms. Eichen already knew this information. She was the one who found out about the information when she went to Rhianne Drummond to have this run and pointed it out to Ms. Drummond. Why would Ms. Eichen, knowing that this is a code of conduct violation, point out a code of conduct violation on herself? Secondly, we have the issue of the fact that there was no cradle-to-grave investigation done, and both Ms. Hoffman and Ms. Moulton testified that that was able to be done at this time, and in fact, they routinely did this at that time. Third, Mr. Jones said, wait a minute, in the course of the reporting this to the investigator, well, it wasn't like I was telling her she couldn't do this. I would have given her permission to do it anyway. This, you know, what is the harm here in this situation if in fact she did access it when she already knew this information based on her prior access by permission back in February, and the fact that Mr. Jones was saying it really wasn't that big of a deal. We have that argument exists in the Stalder case.
That doesn't mean the company isn't entitled to treat it as a big deal.
I didn't say that. I'm just saying if you look at all the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, coupled with the fact that Mr. Shaw, at the time that this is being done, this whole problem is occurring, is saying that we have to get rid of her, that all gets you to the issue of whether this is good faith and whether you can go behind and look at it on that issue. Thank you.
Hey, thanks. Steve, we take under advisement.